we'll reintroduce. We're doing the Book of Judges. The Book of Judges, where our tradition, the Talmud says, in Tractate Baba Basra, was written by the prophet Shmuel. As we discussed in our broader introduction, the book is not a book of history. The point of the book is to give an eternal message. That's why it was recorded, because the message of the book has a message for every generation. And so we are in the middle of the story. We are almost three centuries into the period of the judges, as in Joshua led us into the land of Israel. And in the text, it seems he was king for 14 years. We have sources that say there, Olam Rabbah, that he was 24 years that he led the Jewish people in Israel. And then Yoshua passed away. And then we enter a period of judges. And that's where we're holding. We had discussed the Midrash, that we're going to have a judge from each and every tribe. And we had left off with the story of Gidon. We had concluded the story of Gidon, where Gidon had led us to a great victory. We had an army of 300 people, and we were outnumbered 300-1. They had the whole size of our army for each soldier, and Gidon led that great victory. And after the victory against the Midianites and the other descendants of Abraham, the other Yishmaelim and the nations of the east, so Gidon refused to take the throne. Gidon says, Hashem is your leader, I did my job. And he retires back to his home in Gilad, in the eastern side of the Jordan. And we see, as we will see over and over again, a disproportionate amount of action taking place in the area of Gilad, over here on the eastern side of the Jordan. If we were to analyze it from a historic perspective, we could argue that Gilad was an area where we were most vulnerable. Our enemies could attack us first in the area of Gilad. The Talmud says that Gilad was a problematic area, that there were many murderers there in Jewish history. BeGilad Shchichei Rotzchim, the Gemara says. And we'll have to get back to that. Yes?
I have a question about Gilad. Why does he ask for a sign how the war is going to go? Because Hashem told him to do the war. So he has to do the war. If he loses, I win. So then what, right? Like if Hashem tells you to do something, you have to do it, right?
So that's a very good question.
I wouldn't like to know if Hashem said, no, you're going to lose the war. Like, I wouldn't feel like, yeah.
So Nachmanides, in his letter, Torat Hashem Temima, explains that the idea of a sign is that it's as though the sign is a beginning of an enactment of a decree in heaven. Hashem makes a decree. But if it didn't start happening, then it could be Hashem will say, you don't deserve it anymore. You did this wrong, you did that wrong. We have examples of that in Tanakh. Hashem promised us that the second coming into Israel would be as miraculous as the first one, but it didn't happen. Our tradition is that it didn't happen because the Jews didn't do their end of it. The Jews didn't come. Ezra tried to get people to come and they refused. And that's why the second coming was not as miraculous. So we have different examples of that, including in this week's parsha, where Hashem tells us it's going to be one way, but there's a built-in clause, there's the understanding, it's going to be this way if you live up to your end of it. So when a person has a sign, what's happened is there's the beginning of the fruition. It's come to play. And so the sign is a way of so to speak, solidifying the deal. That here, it's already started. So to speak, you've made your first payment. So that's how Nachmanides explains the concept of signs. We start the year by eating a sweet apple dipped in sweet honey, as if to say, Hashem, if you already decreed we should have a sweet year, look, we already started. And so it should continue. Okay, back to our story. So Gidon passed away. We had learned that Gidon led a private life. He went back home and had a lot of time, given that he was not so invested in the people. And so he had 70 sons, and he had a concubine in the city of Shechem. And if you notice, throughout Jewish history, Shechem is a place that spells trouble for the Jewish people. It starts in next week's parsha with the Dina being abducted in Shechem. It continues with the sons of Jacob killing out the city against their father's will, and then a massive war breaks out after that. There's a huge danger to the Jewish people. Later on, Yosef gets sold in Shechem. The kingdom of David is divided in Shechem. And here in our parsha, we're going in our section over here, we're going to see that specifically his son, that comes from his concubine in Shechem, is the one that's going to stir up trouble. Yes. Ah, yeah, so Gidon passes away, and we learned last week that his son from his concubine in Shechem, he named him Avimelech, not such a Jewish name. That was the name of the kings, the Philistine kings. And he goes to his relatives in Shechem, and he says, why should you risk one of my brothers taking the throne, taking the leadership? You're much better off appointing me as king. And they give him 70 coins, corresponding to the 70 sons of Gidon, and he hires armed men, and he comes back and rounds up his brothers, and this is where we left off last week. He's rounded them up, he's come to their home territory, he's invented a threat. There really was no threat. No one was interested in taking the throne. There was no throne, there was no leadership. He's invented the threat to get the people to appoint him as king. And now he gathers all his brothers and he slaughters them one by one on one stone, slaughters all his brothers. One brother escapes, the brother named Yotam. And the people of Shechem gather to celebrate. They are now appointing Avimelech as their king. And when they sit down and they're having this big party in Shechem, celebrating Avimelech as their new king, so Yotam hears of this. And he goes north of Shechem to the area called Mount Gerizim. And he's staying, he's keeping his distance. And he calls out to them and he says, listen, you leaders of Shechem, and may God hear you. May God hear what I'm about to say. Yes?
Is it the same Avimelech we heard about?
No. This is an Avimelech that was born right now. Gidon named him Avimelech. He was one of Gidon's 70 children. I don't know why he named him Avimelech. I don't know.
That's weird.
But perhaps because the name reflects Gidon's philosophy. Avi, my father in heaven, is Melech, is the king. Perhaps that was Gidon's intention when he named him that. And Avimelech comes in and he takes the name as though it means my father was fit to be your king, and because I'm his son, I should be your king. We see our sages say that they had asked Gidon, Mesholbanu gam ata, gam bincha, gam ben benecha, rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson. And Gidon responds and he says, Lo imshol beni bachem, my son won't rule over you, I won't rule over you, Hashem will rule over you. So his whole approach is they should fear Hashem. They don't need him to have any clout. So I don't know. I hear. I don't know. The Gemara in Tractate Yuma tells us that when people are given the names that are distinctly names for evil people, that affects them. Was Avimelech the distinct name of an evil person? I don't know. So he tells them the following allegory. He says, listen to me and may God hear you. The trees went to appoint a ruler and they went to the olive tree and they said, you be king over us. And the olive tree said, but I have so much, I give out oil and I am used to honor God, I am used to honor people, people use me for light. I can't just spend my time doing idle things like waving over you as though I'm your king. So they went to the fig tree and they said, you be king over us. And the fig tree said, I have such good bounty. Our sages say the fig is the one fruit where you eat the seeds, you eat the fruit, you eat the peel. Everything about a fig gets eaten. So the fig tree says, I give sweet, good food. Our sages say the fig tree is very healthy for a person to eat. I can't do that. Just to spend my time swaying over the other trees. So they go to the grape tree, and the grapevine says, I give off wine, I'm the only thing that over which they sing in the temple. They would give song in the temple when they would libate the wine. And people rejoice when they drink me. I have unique characteristics. I can't just spend my time swaying over the other trees. So all the trees united and they went to the thorn bush and they said, you be king over us. Now you understand the message. He's saying, my father left you with a message. You don't need a king. If you do what's right, what is a king going to do? All he's going to do is sway over you. Anyone that has something to be productive about is going to be productive in their life, and they won't have the time to be your king. Ah, but you went and appointed the thorn bush. What can the thorn bush do? So the thorn tree says to the other trees, he says, well, if you're sincere in appointing me, then come take cover in my shade. I'll sway over you. Now the thorn tree doesn't offer shade. And if you're not, if it was all a farce, so then a fire should emanate from me and burn all of you, because that's what I can offer you. So too says Yotam. If what you've done is fair to my father, and if what you've paid him back after he saved you and he risked his life to save you from the Midianites, and you murdered all his sons, and what you did, if you think was fair, so then may you have blessing if you've been faithful in all of your behavior. But if not, so then a fire should emanate from him and destroy you, and a fire should emanate from you and destroy him. What you've basically done is taken all those who could have been productive and murdered them and appointed one who can offer you nothing but destruction. Look at what he's done. What right does he have to the throne? Only because he murdered his brothers? What has he done to prove himself? So you've appointed him as king. Okay, and with that Yotam runs. And for 3 years Avimelech is king. And then Hashem causes there to be a rift between him and the people of Shechem. And they rebel against him. And they start ambushing his chariots. And this is how Hashem's fulfilling Yotam's curse. He's paying him back. And whenever he'd have caravans with goods passing near Shechem, the people of Shechem would ambush them. And then a man named Gal ben Eved, Rashi says he was not a Jew, he came to town, and the people of Shechem see that he's a big talker, and they have confidence in him. And so when he's there, they have the courage to go out and harvest their grapes. Until then, they knew they had gotten Avimelech upset, and they were scared of him. Now that he showed up, they went and harvested the grapes, and they made parties. And then they had a church there. They went into this pagan house of worship, and they started eating and drinking and cursing Avimelech. So Gal ben Eved says, who's he? What has he done for us? Does he even come from Shechem? His father, but who's he? You want to serve someone because of his father? So let's go serve Hamor, the ancient king of this territory, right? In the days of Jacob, we'll learn in next week's parsha. Why should we serve him? Who's he? What does he have anything to do with us? If I could, I'd take you guys out to war and tell Avimelech, come, let's see you. Bring on your army. Let's see what you can do. So in cursing out Avimelech, Gal ben Eved also says, and why are we even listening to his governor hear Zvul in the city? So the governor, the mayor, hears this, and he says, what's he doing? He's turning the whole city against me and Avimelech. So he sends word to Avimelech that night. Avimelech was camping in a place called Torma, not far away. He says, you should know Gal ben Eved is arousing the people against you, and you better come tonight and lay ambush in the field. They're going to go out and harvest their crops. As the sun rises, they're going to go out. Then you could conquer the city, and you do whatever you think is right. So Avimelech takes his army, and he prepares 4 battalions to charge. And they're there in the field. They're laying ambush. And Gal ben Eved comes out in the morning. He's standing by the gates. And Avimelech and his men start approaching from the ambush. Gal ben Eved is standing next to the governor's Zvul, and he says, do you see those people coming from the mountains? And Zvul says, no, no, no. You see the sun's rising. As the sun rises, the shadow of the mountains moves. That's what you're seeing. And Gal says, no, I see people now. It's very clear. It's people there. So Zvul says, where's your big mouth now? You said, why should we serve Avimelech? There, go fight him now. And Gal ben Eved does that. He leads the people of Shechem, and he fights Avimelech. And Avimelech wins the first day's battle. And Zvul kicks out Gal and his brothers from the city of Shechem. The next morning, the people think it's over. They go out to the fields. Avimelech hears they've gone out to the fields. He prepares 3 points of attack. He lays ambush again. And when the people leave the city, He attacks them. This was the way the cities were set up back then. You lived inside the city. You went outside the city to go work. The fields were outside the city. And they sent the two points of attack on the people in the field. Avimelech personally went to the gates of the city and took his force and secured that no one could re-enter the city. He entered the city and murdered everyone he could find in the city. Some people tried to escape to a tower, and Avimelech destroys the tower and burns it down and kills all the people inside the tower. And then Avimelech continues to another city, Teivetz. Same story. They try to gather into a tower, into a church, and Avimelech has them burn it down. And as he's approaching the tower to burn it down, a woman throws out a large piece of the mill, a large stone, and she bashes his skull, and he's going to die. So he tells his lad, "Kill me quickly. They shouldn't say I was killed by a woman." And so his lad takes out his sword and he kills him. And when they see he's dead, the rest of the army has no interest in making this war. So here Hashem repaid Avimelech and the people. And with that, we conclude the kingdom of Avimelech. Let's recall, what was unique about Avimelech? He was the son of the concubine from Shechem. Right? So we see that Gidon has wives, and from their children, everything's okay. He takes on a concubine, a wife where he's not so faithful to her, she's not so faithful to him, and the son from that wife causes all the problems. Let's remember that, because our sages say that if people try to take on more wives and think they'll skimp corners, like they'll capture a woman at war, and they'll say, "Oh, why don't you marry me?" Well, that's going to cause problems in their home. Ultimately, those children will turn against them, as happened to King David. And we will see in a minute, the story seems to repeat itself. So, we learned about Ya'ir HaGiladi, right? Another great leader called Ya'ir, also from the territory of Gilad, the eastern side of the Jordan. And again, the Jewish people start transgressing. They worship all kinds of different idols. And Hashem gives them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. Now, there's a big discussion among archaeologists, who are the Philistines? Is it one nation? Or does the word Plishti, which we see always enters from our western side, from the port cities, Gaza, Ashkelon, or is the word Plishti from the word Polesh, which means to...
Hysteria, no?
No.
I heard that. The root word Pei Lamed Shin comes from hysteria induced by rolling around in the dirt or something, or in ashes or something.
Don't know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The word Polesh usually means to break through, to invade, to break into a territory. So it's possible that the Plishtim were not always the same people. We're not sure if every time we learn in Tanakh about Plishtim, are they the same Plishtim or are they nations that used to attack from the sea and then conquer swaths of land by the port cities? So we are starting to see the Plishtim are causing problems, even though they're not the major threat yet. They will be. And later on, by next week, we'll be learning about the Plishtim taking over Israel. And for the rest of the book of Judges, we're going to have to deal with the Plishtim, and we never will until King David comes to the scene, even in King Saul's time. So the Plishti are going to become the number one threat. But right now, our major threat is going to be the Ammonites, as we'll see in a minute. Yes?
Can you explain I don't understand. A concubine, she's legally someone's husband. How does it work legally that someone can... She's a wife or she's not a wife?
So... In the days of the kings and the days of the judges, a person could agree with a woman that he's engaging her, he's doing kiddushin, he'll be with her, but he's not giving her ksuba. He's not obligating himself monetarily to her. And that means that if both of them decide to end their relationship, then he can divorce her without any monetary penalties. So there's no monetary obligation. It's a very light relationship. Our sages didn't want that. Our sages wanted us to be obligated so that the relationship would be long-term and we would actually build families. But there were instances where people took on one or two or whatever women who they had a relationship with, and it was a legal relationship. She's not allowed to go with anyone else. It's not a woman of ill repute. But nonetheless, It was a less obligatory relationship, which had intrinsic meaning to it, meaning it was very clear that this was the concubine, this was not the wife. So what I gave you was one interpretation. There's a discussion between Rashi and Nachmanides. Exactly. The word pilegesh, some say, comes from the word plag isha, half a woman, half a wife. She doesn't have the full obligations. She doesn't get the same thing a regular wife does. So, after Ya'ir HaGiladi, we said,
is it a job?
Is it a job? I don't know. I don't know.
It's like a legal version of prostitution, essentially.
It seems like they had long-term relationships with Pilagesh. King David had Pilagshim, who he had for life. He never released them. Even after they were violated by his son Avshalom, and he couldn't be with them again, after what had happened, he never divorced them because he said, why should I hurt their feelings? So he kept them on and he funded them. He said, if I divorce them, no one else could marry them. No one's allowed to marry the divorcee of a king unless it's another king. So he said, there's no other king in Israel now. If I divorce them, the only thing that'll happen, two things will happen. I will be allowed to marry more wives and I will be hurting their feelings. I'm not hurting their feelings. So I'm not marrying more wives. And even when his health depended on it, when the doctors told him that the only way he could get out of his shivers and his tremors would be by marrying a virgin, whatever medication that was, don't ask me, I have no idea. But that's what the doctors of the day told him. He said, no, I can't do it. And he went into a life of seclusion at the end of his life, rather than hurt the feelings of those six concubines who he wouldn't live with again anyways, just so as not to hurt their feelings. He could have divorced them and kept them on as the king's divorcees, given them the same benefits, but they would have been divorcees and that would have hurt their feelings. Look, this is an angle of King David's piety that people sometimes don't know about. You know, he preferred to have problems with his own health, with his own life, but not hurt their feelings. Back to our story. So, we have 18 years where our enemies begin by, the Ammonites begin by taking over the territory on the eastern side of the Jordan, and then they start penetrating into Judean territory, into the territory of Benjamin, so they're starting to pose a threat to mainland Israel. Now, the Jews call out to Hashem, and Hashem says, what do you want from me? You went after all those pagan gods. Go ask them for help. And so the Jews say, Hashem, no, we want you to take care of us. And they start a mass tshuva process, removing all the idols from the land. And the Ammonites unite in Gilad. Again, we see them uniting for war in Gilad. They're about to attack the area on the eastern side of the Jordan again. And the Jews gather corresponding in Mitzpah, wherever that was, somewhere in the north. And when the Ammonites hear that, they go back home, but they're prepared for war. And so the nation realizes they also have to be prepared for war. They say, who's going to lead us to war? The Ammonites are a threat. They're going to come back. It's not done. So here we pause and we hear the story of Yiftach. There was a man in Gilad. Okay, so we had Gidon was in the area on the eastern side of the Jordan, in the area of Gilad, and Yiftach is in the area of Gilad. And Yiftach's bad luck, his mother was a zona. So zona literally means a woman of ill repute. But Yiftach's father, his name was Gilad, Yiftach's father, he and she had a relationship for those 9 months. He knew that Yiftach was his son. That's the literal reading of the text. And then when Yiftach grew up, so he took care of him. He wasn't a deadbeat dad. Gilad took in Yiftach and brought him up with his own kids. The only thing is that when they all grew up, so the other kids said to Yiftach, you have no right to inherit. You get out of here. You're not one of dad's sons. But they were wrong. Halachically, a person has a child, even from a woman of ill repute, that child inherits him. That's his son. If he knows that's his child, so that child does inherit. And the elders of the city of Gilad did not intervene to protect Yiftach's rights. So that's one interpretation to the story. Our tradition is that there's another interpretation, that in the period of the judges, the Jews were still living in segregated communities. Every tribe married within itself. And when a woman would marry into another tribe, they would call her a woman of ill repute. Look at her. She's leaving the tribe. She couldn't find a husband in the tribe. So he's called Ben Isha Zonah, because the word Zonah means one who goes astray. Liznot, when we go astray after idol worships, so Hashem says, you were, we say it in Kriya Shema, V'lo taturu acharei levavchem acharei enichem, don't go after your eyes and your hearts, right? Asher atem zonim achareihem, that you tend to go astray after them. So it's the same root. The word zoneh doesn't have to mean going with a woman of ill repute. It means to go astray. So this was considered that the woman went astray. She had her tribe, and she went to marry someone else. So that's the second interpretation. Yes, Ariel.
Aren't you related to people in your tribe in like one way or another?
We're all related in one way or another.
Like
the tribes numbered a quarter of a million people. I'm saying that's so related. Yeah.
Which tribe did Yiftach mother belong to, and which tribe did Gilad? Did it mention?
So Yiftach, I think, was from the tribe of Menashe, and his mother, I don't know what tribe she was from. I don't know. So Yiftach is pestered by his siblings. He runs away, and he starts forming a band. He has a group of gangsters with him. And now that the Ammonites are threatening, so the elders come to Yiftach and they say, we want you to lead us to war. So you be our general. And Yiftach says to the elders, you guys hated me. Where were you when I was chased out of the house? Why are you coming to me now? Just because you have problems? Now, some want to say that Yiftach had a history. We'll see in Yiftach's conversations later, there's an indication there that can be understood that in previous battles, he actually fought the Ammonites, so they knew he could do it. So the elders of Gilad tell Yiftach, you're right, we've come back, but if you fight for us, then we will appoint you as the governor. You'll be in charge of all of Gilad territory. And Yiftach says, thank you. If I win the war, of course I'm in charge. You want me to lead you to war? You put me in charge now. Don't wait till I won the war. If I'm the one who's leading to war, so then I should be the leader now. So they say, fine, we promise. They bring him back, and Yiftach gathers the people. First he prays to Hashem, and he then turns to the Ammonite king, and he sends him messengers, and he says, why are you picking a fight with me? Why are you fighting my land? And the Ammonite king says, guys, listen closely, you probably never heard this argument, and he says, all I want is peace. Give me land and we'll have peace. You guys stole my land. And he says, if you just give me back my land, I will give you peace. Because when you guys left Egypt, so you took tremendous swaths of land that belonged to Moab. Now, where's the truth in the argument? Before we came to this area, there was a war. Years earlier, there was a war between the Amori kings and the Moabite king. And they conquered swaths of land from Moab. And after they conquered that, then we conquered the Amori and we took that land. God forbade us from taking Moabite land. But this was land that was no longer Moabite land. Years earlier, the Amori had conquered it from them, Sihon and Og. So now when we didn't take it from them, we conquered it from Sihon and Og, who attacked us. We didn't even attack Sihon and Og. So he's saying, give me these large areas of territory, the Reuven territory, Menashe territory, give me that land and things will be fine. So Yiftach says, but that's not true. Because when we left Egypt, we wanted to come northward. There was Amalek here and there were the Edomites in the south. They said no. So we had to go around Edom. So we went eastward. Then we went north. And we asked Moabites, they wouldn't let us enter through their land. So again, we had to go around Moabite territory. We went all the way to the east into the desert. Then we traveled north. And then when we reached halfway up Israel territory, we wanted to go back west into Israel. And then we were attacked by Sihon and Og. And we had just asked them for permission to pass into Israel. And when we won that war, that's when we conquered this territory. Where have you been for 300 years? Why haven't you guys done anything about it? If you really think it's yours, you have an idol, Chemosh, That's the name of their idol. He lets you conquer whatever you conquer. And he's alluding to him. He's saying to him, your God couldn't do anything for you. You see that you were defeated by the Amori. And we defeated the Amori who defeated you. So why are you starting with us? You think you're any better than the Moabite king 300 years ago? He tried fighting and he lost. So now you're going to start with us? Well, I've done you no harm. And Hashem will judge between us. And the king of Ammon refuses to listen. Yiftach gets word that the Ammonite king did not accept his arguments. He doesn't wait. What Yiftach does next is genius. He gathers his forces and he attacks. So instead of having the war in Israeli territory, all the war is taking place in Moabite territory. He doesn't wait. He's not waiting. This is a six-day war before the six-day war, right? Yeah, pre-six-day war, same tactic. He gathers his forces, goes south, and attacks Moab in his hometown, and defeats them. 20 cities destroyed. And once they've lost 20 cities, the Moabites, they all put up white flags. They admit defeat. And Yiftach sees his great victory, so he makes a vow. He says, Ribono shel Olam, the first thing to greet me on my way home, well, I will give him, I will sacrifice to you. And as he comes home, he hadn't had any children. His wife might have been on her second marriage. He had one daughter, and she comes out playing music, her tambourine, dancing in his honor that he had such a victory. And when he sees her, he tears his clothing and starts weeping. He says, you know, I promised Hashem I can't take it back. Yiftach was not a learned person. So his daughter says, well, you had such a victory. You'll do what you promised. What'd you promise? He says, I promised I'd offer as a sacrifice whatever is the first thing to greet me that comes out of the door. So she says, but Dad, Yaakov Avinu promised he'd give a tithe to Hashem. And he had 10 children. He didn't sacrifice one. And so he had one that was dedicated to the service of Hashem, but he didn't sacrifice a child. And she starts giving him very strong Talmudic arguments, and he can't answer her. He doesn't know.
He's the least of all the prophets, isn't he?
Right. From him, we learn the concept that just because you want to be pious, that's not enough. You got to know Torah, otherwise, with the best intentions, people can do the worst things. And he says, I don't see a way out. I took a vow. I got to do it. And again, she gives him arguments, and he's not willing to listen. And she says, maybe the court will annul your vow. And Pinchas, the head of the court, hears what's going on. And Pinchas says, well, Yiftach can come here, and we'll find the solution. And Yiftach says, I'm the great leader. I just won this war. Pinchas can come to me. And between the two of them, the daughter was lost. We have two interpretations as to what happened with her. One opinion says, he locked her up in a house and said, you just pray to God. That's what you do all year. And he locked her up. She became a hermit, and he can't stay sane for too long being locked up in a house with all you got to do is pray all day. Okay, on a mountain. He lived on a mountain. So one interpretation says he didn't actually slaughter her. The other interpretation says he did. Two interpretations as to what he did when he says, I dedicated you to God. And our sages say that he died shortly thereafter. He was only king for 6 years. He was only ruler. And Pinchas lost his prophecy. It says in Chronicles that Hashem wouldn't talk to him again after this story. But here again, we saw with Gideon, his son that came from the illegitimate wife or the less legitimate wife was problematic. Yiftach came from the illegitimate wife. He's problematic. But the story is not done yet. Because the people of Ephraim, remember we have over here, Gilad is part of Menashe. And here in Israel, you have Ephraim territory. So they come out, they cross the Jordan, and they say, well, how do you guys appoint your own king? You didn't ask us. Who are you? What's going on here? You appoint your own king, you make your own wars. What's going on here? And they were very upset. Part of what they were upset about was what Yiftach did to his daughter. And Yiftach says, you know, I had a battle with, I had problems with Ammon, and it's been going on and on. You guys never helped us. Now you have an issue with what we did? Look at how victorious we were today. We risked our lives, and Hashem helped us. And Yiftach does not have the humility of Gideon. Remember, when Gideon led the victory, the people of Ephraim also came and argued with him. What are you doing going to war without talking to us? So the people of Ephraim were not too learned. They were shepherds. They were people who did not know too much, but they were very quarrelsome. So with Gideon, Gidon appeased them. With Yiftach, Yiftach says, no problem. He draws his sword and gathers his men and starts killing the people of Ephraim. And he orders his men to capture the Jordan and not let the people of Ephraim go back home. Now, the people of Ephraim were shepherds, we said. They would take their sheep out into the eastern side of the Jordan where the land was lush, and they'd graze their sheep. Suddenly, 42,000 men are stuck on the eastern side of the Jordan. They can't go home. Now, the people of Ephraim would always mock them. They'd say, you guys are a divided tribe. Menashe is partially on the eastern side of the Jordan, partially on the western side of the Jordan. You're all interspersed among us. They'd put down the tribe of Menashe. So, Yiftach's men were always, for years, they were hearing these put-down lines. And so they had this contempt for the people of Ephraim. And when they captured the Jordan, any person who tried to cross, they'd question him, are you from the tribe of Ephraim? And the people would say, no, of course not. So they'd say, fine. Waves, when you have an undercurrent, in Hebrew it's called shibolet. Shibolet is an undercurrent. It's a current. So they say, why don't you tell us about this current? And the people of Ephraim, they had a lisp. They couldn't say the word shibolet. They would say sibolet. And the second they'd hear that, they'd slit their throats. And they killed 42,000 Jews. Yiftach and his men. And Yiftach, again, he's king for 6 years. But here again, we see the problems with a leader. You had Avimelech, who came from a problematic marriage. And you have Yiftach. Rav Herschel Schachter says that the reason why there were so many murderers on the eastern side of the Jordan is possibly because when we entered the land of Israel to conquer the land of Israel, so part of the deal was that the soldiers from the tribes on the eastern part of the Jordan had to go into Israel and help conquer the land, and only after the 14 years of conquering and dividing the land could they go back home. So the Medrash says that these kids grew up without a father. He had a generation, a whole generation. You had a 250,000 people growing up without a father. Well, kids need a father and a mother. And very quickly we see that the eastern side of the Jordan, they're the ones that were punished most in the period of the judges. The Radak says that if the tribe of Ephraim were killed this way, then obviously they deserve the punishment at the hands of heaven. Netan Ofreng, though, I'm just pointing out that I didn't find a source that says that Yiftach was punished over this. Yiftach was punished for killing his daughter or punishing his daughter, whatever he did. But I did not see a source that says that Yiftach was punished for killing 42,000 men of the tribe of Ephraim. It seems like they were rebelling against his leadership, and he had a right to take the sword against them. They threatened him. They told him, we'll kill you and burn your house. Meaning they were threatening his life. So he took the sword and he said, let's see who kills who first. And about that, I didn't find a source that says he was punished. Could be there is. I don't know of it. We see a recurring theme here. Children need a healthy home. Children need a father and a mother. And from here, we finish the story of Yiftach. Our sages say that part of his punishment for what he did with his daughter was that he got covered with boils, and the boils affected him that his body would wither. And that's why the verse says he was buried throughout the cities of Gilad, because he'd visit a city and leave a limb there. His limbs fell off, and that's how he had a slow, painful death. That was his punishment for what he did to his daughter. And that leads us to the story of Ibzan. Yes?
I find it hard to